Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. Southern California, already first in the nation with air pollution, is about to lead the way again, cleaning up the pollution using the profit motive. The plan has its critics, but the South Coast Air Quality Management District is ready to try. Also this time, the nation's oldest environmental group, the Sierra Club, celebrates 100 years with a 2,000-mile hike along the Appalachian Trail.
We're going to be using the Appalachian Trail really as a vehicle, and that vehicle will be to focus attention on the challenges facing us in the next 100 years, our need to focus resources and awareness on the environment.
Keith Tondrick will tell us more. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. The new Clean Air Bill provides a way for industries that emit sulfur dioxide to continue polluting. The polluting industry would operate through buying or selling air pollution permits. The plan has the Environmental Protection Agency issuing an industry a set number of emissions allowances, one credit per ton of emissions. If the industry goes over the allowed pollution limit and uses up its credits, it would be fined. But an industry coming in under the limit would have allowances left over, allowances that could be offered for sale to an industry over its limits. The credits would thus become valuable commodities, motivating an industry to reduce emissions to acquire credits worth a lot of money when sold to those industries unable to reduce below the limit. This is the theory, anyway. The theory is about to become reality. Jim Lentz, executive officer for the South Coast Air Quality Management District in Los Angeles, gives some background.
The Air Quality Management District actually began out of a concern over air quality back in the late 1940s. As this area began to grow, automobiles began to grow here, manufacturing began to grow here, an air quality problem developed, and Los Angeles County formed an air pollution control program in 1948. After that, all the other counties in this area formed a program and tried to operate independently up until 1977, when people realized that this area was so huge, the population was so huge, and that you could not solve the air quality problem with four separate counties. So in 1977, it was combined into a single agency that represented all four counties and given the task of meeting air quality standards in this region.
Southern California has long been the symbol for the nation's air quality problems.
Los Angeles is victimized by its own wonderful climate. The air here is trapped in a basin, causes it to be much warmer in the winter than its latitude would suggest, so that it rarely freezes and you can raise citrus fruits. But it also means that the pollution generated here does not move out readily. We also have abundant sunshine, which contributes to the chemical reactions in the atmosphere. The combination of that, along with 13 million people finding this an attractive place to live, has resulted in the highest ozone levels, ground-level ozone levels, in the entire United States. It also has some of the highest particulate levels, some of the highest carbon monoxide levels, and the only area in the United States that violates nitrogen oxide standards, at least federal nitrogen oxide standards. So overall, it's considered the most air-polluted urban area in the United States.
But Southern California, for this reason, has also been the inventing laboratory. Alternate fuels, electric cars, technologies in solar and wind power, and the catalytic converter are some of the contributions from California to fight air pollution. In fact, says Lentz,
we've committed this area to lower our emissions by 80% over the next 20 years because we believe that it is necessary, I think, to have a growing economic future here to solve the air quality problems and meet federal health standards. Consequently, we've been looking around for how's the best way to do it, how's the best way to take an area this far, because we've actually been a leader in air pollution control over the last 20, 30 years. If you study the average person who lives in Los Angeles, their job, their automobile, et cetera, you'd find out that per person they produce less emissions than people who live in most of the other parts of this nation. It's just that so many do live in this area.
With pollution levels still high, Lent says it has become apparent that neither laws nor the science has been sufficient. In order to move into the next stage of pollution control, he says the management district has put the region on a pollution diet, setting a baseline level of emissions for the area, then requiring polluting industries to back off from that baseline 5% each year. He says the system might work like this.
Well, you might imagine that you would be a company, and because of your particular operations, you have 10 or 15 emission sources, and you're putting out 1,000 pounds of emissions each day. What we would do, we'd allocate you and say, okay, for this next year, you can put out 1,000 pounds of emissions, but the year after this, you have to put out 5% less emissions. So I think it'd be about 950 pounds a day. And the year after that, you've got to put 5% more less. So as a company, you would be looking at yourself over the next decade and say, this is the amount of emissions I've got to get rid of, and I've got to look at how to structure my manufacturing process in order to reduce those emissions. Now, you have one other opportunity. If you feel like it's just not practical for your particular type of company to reduce emissions further, or that it's too costly, you could work with a neighboring industry or an industry across town which has found a way to reduce their emissions because of their particular product more than the 5% they would be required to do. And you could work out a deal where maybe they would reduce their emissions 10% and you wouldn't have to reduce your emissions at all, and then you could work a trade up. So it economically lets you find the most cost-effective emission reductions in the area.
The plan is not without its critics. Industry worries the baseline level will be neither achievable nor sustainable. Environmentalists say the real problem will be enforcement.
We're trying to deal with both sides, and one is to set realistic baselines to start from. Can we live with emission reductions in the future? We have made a commitment, I think, the population in this area, that we're going to have healthy air to breathe here, and we're going to have to learn how to live with these emission reductions, and what we need to do is inspire people to come up with them. As far as the enforcement side that the environmentalists are concerned with, we think modern data handling, data processing technology offers us some opportunities that didn't exist even a decade ago, to monitor how companies produce pollution so that we feel like the program is enforceable even with the flexibility that we would allow.
Other critics warn the plan will favor the larger industries that have the financial advantage over smaller operations. The larger you are, the more you can afford to take offline old, inefficient equipment and even purchase new, cleaner technology. A smaller firm often lives closer to the wire. Jim Lentz.
We think just the opposite will happen. We think that over the last two decades of air pollution control, say starting in 1967 when Congress passed sort of the first varieties of the National Clean Air Act, that the program has been focused on big sources. We in Los Angeles has focused on big sources, and we've required much controls to in order to get the next increment of controls at most of our big sources, refineries and utilities, we here in Los Angeles are asking them to spend almost $40,000 a ton in some cases to get rid of a ton of emissions. Whereas because small companies are less sophisticated, we've tended to cut them a little more slack, and their control costs have been generally held down to around $6,000-$7,000 per ton. So economically, there's more opportunity to clean up in the smaller sources in many cases than the large sources. Where I think that the small sources will benefit, the large sources will still be mandated to lower their emissions under this program, even though it's very expensive for them. But the economic market will encourage them to buy to actually buy shares from smaller companies. And in a sense, what they're doing is they're economically helping the small companies clean up so that under this system, you will actually force the bigger guys to help the smaller guys clean up while they're all attempting to meet their emissions reduction quotas. So we think it's actually an advantage on both sides.
Jim Lentz, executive officer of the California South Coast Air Quality Management District in Los Angeles. He says the plan will be at least a year in design. He says initially 2,800 firms in the L.A. Basin will be eligible to participate once the plan is in place. This is Bruce Robertson. The United Nations Conference on Environment and Development in Rio de Janeiro this June is already presenting powerful challenges and choices to both the developed and the developing world. Over 150 nations are expected to send delegations. So far, though, for the United States, the biggest question has been whether even to attend. Critics of the Bush administration view this indecision with great alarm. Commentator Ruth Rosen, professor of history at the University of California, Davis, says by attending, President Bush would seize his greatest opportunity yet to be the leader of his so-called New World Order.
Rather than providing leadership as the world's one superpower, the United States is acting as if it wishes the Earth Summit would just go away. The United States delegation, for example, first refused to offer any funds to finance sustainable development in the South. Now it is offered a mere $75 million. The United States also opposes the creation of new institutions to deal with global sustainable development. At the Earth Summit, North and South will thrash out how to balance development pressures against an increasingly imperiled global environment. So the question on the table is, can a sustainable future be founded on environmentally sound and equitable policies? The South accuses the North of rank hypocrisy. The North, after all, has recklessly destroyed its own forests and fouled the planet's water and air. Now the developed North is asking the South to halt deforestation and to pursue economic development with sound environmental policies. And much of the South is ready to comply, but justifiably wants the North to compensate undeveloped nations for the sacrifices they must make. And the South is justifiably suspicious of the North's commitment to limited growth. They fear the North will force them to protect forests, control population growth, and regulate pollution, but won't reverse their own wasteful consumptive patterns. And their suspicions are well-grounded, for that is precisely what President Bush, who ran as the environmental president in 1988, has been unwilling to do. So in the middle of a worsening recession, it is reasonable to ask why Americans should even care about this Earth Summit. And even if they do, how can this country afford to help the developing South? Well, Americans are hardly immune to the dangers of a depleted ozone layer or a degraded environment. Also, the United States will become even less competitive if it fails to become more energy efficient. Germany and Japan, for example, have set limits and deadlines to decrease their carbon dioxide emissions, and simultaneously they have developed more energy-efficient technologies. By contrast, the United States has no energy policy. The calculus is simple. Goods produced with less energy cost less. The United States, already a weakened competitor, will slide deeper into debt. So the question is not whether we can afford to help the South, but whether we can afford not to contribute to this new world order. And helping the South is not an act of charity. Through debt relief, changes in trade terms, bank credits, and other incentives, the North can help undeveloped countries grow in environmentally friendly ways. It can also reverse the present flow of capital from the third world to the developed nations. But neither Democrats nor Republicans are really focusing on North-South divisions and global environmental problems in this present campaign. If President Bush is serious about the vision thing, this is his chance to prove that the Earth Summit will be more than a photo op for his campaign. If the Democrats want to prove they stand for more than rhetoric, they must convince a weary public that in energy-efficient nations can create jobs that don't threaten the environment. Above all, they must avoid pandering to the short-sighted politics of isolationism. It's easy for a superpower to throw around its military weight. It takes a different kind of courage to redefine global security toward a safer world. If not for us, then for the next generation.
Ruth Rosen, professor of history at the University of California at Davis. Her views expressed also appeared as a commentary in the Christian Science Monitor newspaper. This year, the nation's oldest environmental organization, the Sierra Club, will mark 100 years of activism with many celebrations, speeches, and publications. None of the activities planned is as unique as the one expected to cover over 2,000 miles and take nearly 6 months to complete. Beginning Sunday, March 15th and ending Saturday, September 5th, a small team of six men and one woman will hike the entire length of the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine. Keith Tondrick is field coordinator for the expedition.
We're going to be beginning in a place called Amicalola Falls State Park in Georgia, which is about 9 miles below Springer Mountain. And Springer Mountain is where the actual Appalachian Trail begins, but we'll be taking a 9-mile side trail that leads up to Springer as the start of our hike.
Now, what's the idea behind hiking this trail and celebrating the club's 100 years?
Three reasons behind there that we have. First and foremost, I guess, would be the simply celebrating the 100th birthday of the Sierra Club. And we felt that a club of with the significance that the Sierra Club had, it needed a great expedition to do that celebration. And so we will be hiking the Appalachian Trail. We're going to be using the Appalachian Trail really as a vehicle, and that vehicle will be to focus attention on the challenges facing us in the next 100 years, our need to focus resources and awareness on the environment, and in addition to drum up grassroots involvement of citizens in the environmental process, not only to make them aware of the challenges that are obviously facing our nation and the world, but also to say, hey, it's time to take charge. It's time for you to become involved in the process. And that's the message that we're going to be sending as we hike the Appalachian Trail.
Formed in the 1920s, the Appalachian Trail covers 2,140 miles of fairly rugged, varied terrain along the east coast of the United States.
Starting in Georgia, you're in the northern part of the state, traversing through western North Carolina, eastern Tennessee, through the heart of the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, into southwest Virginia at Damascus, Virginia, through Parisburg and up to Roanoke, Virginia, where it essentially joins the Blue Ridge Mountains, along the crest of the Blue Ridge Mountains, paralleling part of the Blue Ridge Parkway in the Shenandoah National Park for its entire length, and then on through to Harpers Ferry, West Virginia, which is the Appalachian Trail Conference headquarters. 40 miles of the Appalachian Trail goes through the state of Maryland, and then into Pennsylvania, again on the Blue Ridge, over to pretty much Harrisburg, a town called Duncannon, Pennsylvania, crosses the Susquehanna there, and then in the Appalachian Ridge Mountains of Pennsylvania through to Delaware Water Gap, through very northwest part of New Jersey, into New York around Bear Mountain State Park, and then into western Connecticut and western Massachusetts, into the Green Mountains of Vermont, where it parallels the long trail up to about Rutland, I believe, and then we make a cut and we'll head into across the Connecticut River into the Hanover, New Hampshire, and then into the Great White Mountains with their unpredictable weather, and then into Maine, where the trail continues in a pretty much a wilderness state, right on up to Baxter State Park, and its northern terminus, Mount Katahdin.
Tondrick says the expedition has been in the planning for 2 years, with a shakedown hike completed last spring in Virginia. Some equipment to be used on the trek has been donated by various manufacturers of outdoor gear. Tondrick says the group spent the rest of the year getting used to the equipment and to each other.
In addition, of course, we have seven of us doing the hike. We've been, we've had almost a year now to help plan to get our lives in order, because essentially you're putting your life on hold. You're leaving society as you know it, and leaving your family and your house, and taking off and getting together with six other people that you don't know all that well, and hiking the entire Appalachian Trail. It's a big change from our day-to-day existence now. So getting our minds set, or getting our minds right, is another integral part of the trip, and we've been doing that too. And of course, in addition, we've got a lot of celebrations we have going on, and we've been working on getting information out to the public and to the Sierra Club about the hike. So there's been a lot of publicity that's also been going on.
The expedition members plan to come out of the woods at a number of selected sites to speak to local residents. Called celebrations, these events are being planned as a way for the public to get involved in the expedition and its goals.
Each celebration also is going to have a particular slant or message that will be promoted at that event.
For example?
Example, at the on the expedition kickoff at Amicalola Falls, the message is going to be based on sowing seeds for the future, talking about, future environmental concerns and problems that the club's going to be involved with. At Cherokee, North Carolina, which is right near Great Smoky Mountain National Park, on April 4th, our message is going to be national parks and public lands. And Damascus, Virginia, on April 18th, an individual can make a difference, how an individual can work to help improve the environment, and so forth on up the line.
Keith Tondrick, on-trail coordinator for the Sierra Club Appalachian Trail Centennial Expedition. The expedition is undertaking something 2,000 others attempt each year. However, says Tondrick, only about 10% actually make it the length of the trail, the others dropping out for various reasons, including black flies, mosquitoes, sore legs and feet, lack of food, and isolation on the trail. This group has a lot more than just a personal challenge at stake, though. There is 100 years of environmental history to recall. The Sierra Club was founded on May 28, 1892, by John Muir, who had just successfully fought off attempts to reduce the boundaries of Yosemite Park, which he had helped to establish. How would John Muir respond to the challenges of the late 20th century? How are we to respond? These and other questions no doubt will be turning in the minds of the seven hikers slowly making their way north. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show this week. We expect to get weekly reports from the Sierra Expedition as we chart their trek northward. Be listening next time. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, do drop us a line. Address your questions and your comments to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. The address, once again, is The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. You know, we receive many requests for cassette copies of The Environment Show. If you would like to order a copy of this program, just call 1-800-767-1929. You may order with your Visa or MasterCard, or if you wish, pay by check. The operator will give you the information you need. Just ask for The Environment Show, this week, number 115. That number, once again, is 1-800-767-1929. Program, this week, number 115. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.